Jenny here this weekend, beginning to end. I won't help you with speakers, if you know who they are. Our first speaker, in one sense, needs no introduction. It's Mike Griffin, NASA administrator, certainly well known in the news, and he's known to you. He was a speaker at our founding convention in 1998, and again in 2001. But in another sense, I think he needs a reintroduction. And I'm going to do it by telling a story which in one sense has nothing to do with Mike Griffin, but in another sense has everything in my view to do with Mike Griffin. And this goes back a very long time. Many years ago, who here knows who Rick Ogle was? He was the inventor of the nuclear submarine and the civilian nuclear reactor. He's one of the great engineers of the 20th century. And many years ago, I had an opportunity to ask Rick Ogle what he thought was the most essential quality needed by an engineer. And he answered me with one word. He said, courage. And that is what an engineer needs most. And by that, he did not mean physical courage, although that in some ways is an occasional required, but moral courage. The courage to say what you think is true, regardless of whether or not it accords with the company line, or what trouble it might get you into. Say it as you see it. Now, a couple of years ago, I was at a convention where a noted science fiction author who'd been around the space program for many years the British Interplanetary Society, their slogan is from imagination to reality. The British Interplanetary Society was one of the visionary founders of the space age in a certain sense. This was a couple of years ago, before Mike was administrator, and he summed up his view of the history of NASA as from imagination to bureaucracy. Well, we've seen something different, haven't we? And we saw just this past spring here, the shuttle flight, the general operating procedure here in Washington was covered with ash. And of course, we had a shuttle flight here where Mike most definitely did not do that thing. And I think that is the kind of spirit that is required if we're to have a space agency that can get us to Mars. There's going to be risks involved. Okay, and there always will be an infinite sequence of tests, of reconsiderations, of precursor missions, of any number of things that might conceivably mitigate risk, and it will always be possible for whoever is in charge, if they wish, to cop out on pushing ahead by choosing one or another. Now, in some instances, of course, these things may be fully justified, but, okay, at a certain point, you have to decide. At a certain point, you've got to do what it takes. And this spread might show that he has what it takes. So he's a very forceful personality. He's very controversial. Nobody agrees with all of his decisions. I don't agree with all of his decisions, but I certainly agree emphatically with the spirit behind his decisions. So here to tell you how he thinks we can get humans to the moon and Mars, Mike Griffin.
Bob's point about decisions and agreements is well taken. I'm not sure even I agree with all of my decisions. Decisions have to be made, and sometimes things we have to do are not always what we want to do, but are what we think in the broader sense are the best things to do. And that general topic of discord within the space industry is going to be part of what I'm going to talk about today, the the prepared remarks. I'm also going to try to save a good deal of time for questions and answers, since I think experience has taught me that my reading of a speech is at best mediocre, and that's at best. But the audience gets a lot of value out of Q&A, so Bob's allocated an hour, and we have 55 minutes of that remaining, and so I'll try to leave as much of that for you all as possible. So I'll start by saying good morning, and thank you for inviting me to be the warm-up act for Elon Musk. Elon is a much more dynamic speaker than I am. We probably should have had him first, just get everybody awake. Before we get into that, though, let me say that it's good to be among fellow space travelers like Mars Society. You all want to turn the stuff of science fiction into reality, and so do I. Many of you are fellow scientists and engineers with whom I share a common passion, for which the Crew Exploration Vehicle, the Ares 1 crew, and the Ares 5 heavy lift launch vehicles are only the first steps on a long journey to the Moon, Mars, and future destinations in the solar system. So allow me a few minutes to share some of my thoughts for your consideration about where we are and where we are going on this journey. I know that some of you are frustrated by how arduous our journey has been even to this point, and by the many challenges we still face before embarking on mankind's first voyage to Mars. As someone who has devoted his career to the space business, I share these frustrations. But I also think a bit of perspective is in order. This morning, I hope to provoke some thinking among you as members of the Mars Society to try to look at NASA's overall mission rather than at the single goal of the voyage to Mars. In this vein, many of you know that I'm an admirer of NASA's greatest administrator, James Webb. Webb once characterized his role in the Apollo program in the following way, quoting now, "The process of management became that of fusing, at many levels, a large number of forces, some now prevailing, into a cohesive but essentially unstable whole and keeping it in the desired direction," end quote. That's it, exactly. And that perspective serves me well today. There are many disparate goals which are held by NASA's numerous stakeholders, and we try very hard, in fact, to move the agency forward in a manner which promotes unity among rather than division between these stakeholders. It is not easy. If the blunt truth be told, prior to the loss of the Space Shuttle Columbia a few years ago, NASA suffered from a long period of benign neglect by both the public and our government stakeholders concerning the broader purposes of our nation's space enterprise, and especially human spacecraft. NASA's last mission to the Moon was in 1972, and our nation, as a matter of policy, at the highest levels, had chosen to confine itself to low Earth orbit and defense. As I've said on many, many previous occasions, probably will again, I believe this could have been a crucial strategic mistake for this nation. We've come a long way since the dark days of the Columbia accident in building a consensus as to what goals are worthy of our nation's civil space program. And after a lengthy national discourse, the challenge of the President's vision for space exploration was endorsed by the Congress in the NASA Authorization Act of 2005. I firmly believe that the vision is the proper lasting legacy for the astronauts who perished in the Columbia accident. It sets a course in space for our generation and indeed for future generations. This law charges the NASA administrator to, quote, "establish a program to develop a sustained human presence on the Moon, including a robust precursor program, to promote exploration, science, commerce, and the United States preeminence in space, as a stepping stone to future exploration of Mars and other destination nations," end quote. This is wonderful direction. It tells NASA to make the United States, once again, a space-faring nation. Nothing more is necessary, and nothing less is appropriate. The law charges NASA to carry out certain specific programs with the following milestones: return Americans to the Moon not later than 2020. Launch the Crew Exploration Vehicle as close to 2010 as possible, but in no case later than 2014. Increase knowledge of the impacts of long-duration stays in space on the human body using the most appropriate facilities available, including the International Space Station, and enable humans to land on and return from Mars and other destinations on a timetable that is technically and fiscally possible. With this, NASA stakeholders at the White House and in Congress have provided clear direction on the policies and programs that the agency must carry out. And so, while some of you might wish it to be otherwise, NASA's strategic goals are neither solely nor even initially focused upon Mars. We're charged with carrying out a broad portfolio of missions in space exploration, scientific discovery, and aeronautics research. With the resources projected to be available to NASA over the next 5 years, properly balanced with our other national priorities of working space science as well as aeronautics research, we are on course to complete the International Space Station by 2010 and to bring the CGV online no later than 2014. This is a national imperative. With the retirement of the space shuttle by 2010, frankly, a far more urgent concern to me than a future mission to Mars is taking steps to ensure that we have a smooth transition from space shuttle to CGV and to commercial crew and cargo transport services for the International Space Station. Thus, we plan to award a contract for the design and development of the CGV next month, and in the coming weeks, we hope to enter into space act agreements with commercial firms to demonstrate space station resupply capabilities. As I've said previously, if cost-effective commercial services are demonstrated in support of the ISS, NASA will welcome and use them. So let me be clear about what is at the forefront of our attention at NASA at this time. The greatest management challenge we face over the next few years is the safe and effective transition to new exploration systems by completing the remaining shuttle missions for the assembly of the International Space Station, followed by the retirement of the shuttle in 2010 to allow greater focus on missions beyond low Earth orbit. We now have a clear goal for the future. Our current activities can and must be focused to advance that goal. The remaining ISS assembly missions and space shuttle flights will allow us to advance knowledge and help train the next generation of space explorers. More broadly, I believe that the most important aspect of the International Space Station is the tried and tested partnership that has been forged among the space-faring nations of Canada, Europe, Japan, Russia, and the United States. This partnership has endured tremendous hardships and stands by itself as a monumental international accomplishment. We can learn from this experience and expand on its positive aspects as we move forward to the Moon and Mars. At this stage in the development of our plans, it is important that NASA not prescribe roles and responsibilities for future international partnerships. Instead, we have defined a minimalist exploration architecture featuring the CGV, the crew and heavy lift launch vehicles, and a lunar lander as the first elements, with the hope that international and commercial partners will want to augment these capabilities with their own. We're already collaborating with other nations on a series of satellite missions to map the resources of the Moon, and I hope that we'll collaborate on even more missions to the Moon and Mars. This year, we've hosted workshops to discuss with our international partners the scientific community and commercial interests what each of us might do and what we might do together and explore and utilize the Moon. I hope to issue a plan later this fall based on feedback from those workshops. One of the main reasons why discussions for future collaboration in exploiting the Moon have been fruitful is that despite many trials and tribulations, the United States has shown itself to be a good partner on the International Space Station. We need to continue that. Also this year, we have celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Viking mission and begun to lay the groundwork for robotic missions to Mars in the next decade, building on the results from Mars rovers and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Next year, I hope to make plans as to how to carry out missions to Mars, building on the heavy lift launch vehicles, landers, and other capabilities for lunar exploration architecture. We will especially call for the support of our international partners for this long-term endeavor as we build on the relationships which have been forged in assembling the International Space Station. This morning, on board the station, American astronaut Jeff Williams and German astronaut Thomas Reiter are preparing for a six-hour spacewalk to install equipment and experiments around the outside of the ISS. Spacewalk is being choreographed by Russian Commander Pavel Navratilov, who will remain on board the ISS and will be televised by cameras on Canadarm2. Today's spacewalk exemplifies how nations work together at their best. We make it look easy. perhaps even two, maybe those who are not accepting the risks of the space business. However, this spacewalk is not simply science fiction. The ISS is our nation's most technically challenging project, and the spacewalk is one small step forward toward exploration. The ISS is a scientific and engineering test bed that is used before embarking on long journeys to Mars. In fact, the NASA Authorization Act designates the U.S. segment of the space station as a national laboratory, and I'm actively seeking partnerships with other federal agencies like NSF, NIH, and DOD, and commercial entities who would use the ISS for their own experiments while NASA focuses its research directly on exploration-related missions. For example, we know that a crew on such a long journey to Mars would need a great deal of self-sufficiency as we break the 8 or 10 of Earth. A three-person crew on board the space station requires approximately 5,000 gallons of water each year. But by developing and testing equipment and water recycling capabilities to the ISS, the future logistics resupply required will be significantly less. This will have far-reaching implications for future Mars missions. Likewise, learning to use resources on the moon and Mars must prove far more economical than bringing those resources with us on the journey. In situ resource utilization, in fact, using concepts pioneered by Bob and his co-worker, David Baker, making some logistics, international partnerships, and leveraging of commercial space capabilities will help sustain the vision for space exploration, and they're all being tested on board the International Space Station. NASA's priorities are clear. In the wake of the Columbia tragedy, our national leadership realized that human spaceflight is today one of those strategic capabilities that define a nation as a superpower. And I must ask each of you this: is it possible to envision a future in which America is considered to be a leader in the world if others can and do conduct exploration and research on the moon and Mars and beyond, and we cannot? International cooperation, leavened by a healthy dose of competition, is what makes America the greatest country in the world, in my opinion. And the ultimate goal of the vision for space exploration is not to impress others or even merely to explore the moon or Mars, but rather to advance U.S. scientific, security, and economic interests through leadership in the grandest expression of human imagination of which we can conceive. We are turning science fiction into reality. We do what others dream. I'm privileged to be a part of it. Thank you.
We have time for funny questions. Why don't people line up at the mic over here? Questions.
I'll go back and forth between the microphones.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for your courage. My name is Dan Hussein, and I graduated from MIT and now work in IT law. And my question is, what is NASA's policy toward intellectual property that they create in-house, and also the property that is created by their contractor subcontractors? Because one reason that a lot of people give for exploring space is the repercussions that intellectual property that we created to help Latin America. So how is NASA using this intellectual property to both get the money back that was invested into it and also advance the technology along?
I have almost no idea. You need a lawyer to answer questions like that. I mean, right, I'm not. Broadly speaking, intellectual property generated on government dime belongs to the people of this nation and can be is licensed and licensable for free to anyone. And that about sums up my understanding. The contractors do work for us on the government dime, and again, that intellectual property belongs to the people of the United States, not companies. If the companies put their own money into something, then to the extent that they so do, then IP belongs to them. And I've now exhausted my knowledge of the subject and that's how dangerous the coast would see me. Bruce Anderson from Boston. Based on what you know today, what's your best guess when you lose the first walk on Mars? My own personal best guess would be the late 2020s, because by the time we're back to the moon, it will be close to 2020. We will then be in possession of a heavy load launch vehicle, which is, of course, the key element for any approach to going to Mars. A significant amount of mass has to go through low Earth orbit. We don't necessarily have to assemble there, and I'm not trying to describe the architecture of going to Mars, but if you use low Earth orbit as an accounting spot, a lot of mass has to go through low Earth orbit. And I think if we learn one thing from the space station, it's the next time we need to assemble 800,000 pounds in low orbit, I hope we don't try to do it 30,000 pounds at a time. and by the way, the mass of the space station is quite comparable to the sorts of mission mass estimates that we would need to put through low Earth orbit to go to Mars now, depending on how efficient you operate, should be a little more or a little less, also depends on the opportunity. But it's a space station scale mass, and there are things to be in there. So by the late teens, we should be back on the moon, and then we will have a heavy venture, and we will have accumulated by that time and be accumulating substantial experience in working off world. We will have learned how on the space station to make hardware operate for years of time without breaking down. We won't have to deal with that. We don't have to deal with that right now. I think we would be poised at that point by the late teens or 2020. I think we would be poised for a rational national decision then to aim the sources at going to Mars. And once that decision is made, you're 7 or 8 years away from doing it. People are frustrated with the timetable. I'm frustrated with the timetable. I talk constantly to people who literally do not understand that all of the many tens of billions of dollars in today's dollars that we spent building up space infrastructure is gone. That the investments of the Apollo years to build heavy lifters, facilities, things like that are gone. And that we have to recreate capabilities that we once had. It's frustrating, but it is a fact. So it's going to take a little while. Next question.
Gary Fisher from Philadelphia. Thank you, Dr. Griffin, for coming to speak to us again. Last time we spoke to the Mars Society Convention, you gave a list, I think it was 10, possibly 15 things, problems that had to be solved before humans on Mars could be a reality. If you remember that list, I appreciate sort of running down it again. If later today, a number of
I'm almost 57 years old. I can't remember.
later today, a number of us are going to go up to the hill. I was just wondering if there are any specific areas of research and development that need to be addressed better in terms of funding. That would help us get humans to Mars.
Well, the most recent comments I've made about humans to Mars were actually in congressional testimony a couple of years ago as a private citizen, where I again pointed out sort of my list of things that you had to do. I do not believe that, and I said several times, I do not believe there is anything of a fundamental technical nature that prevents us from going to Mars. We have to assume certain levels of risk to do it. We live currently in a very risk-averse society. This is not a society which, to use one of my favorite examples, this is not a society today which would dispatch 5 ships from Spain with the intention of circumnavigating the world, 5 ships containing 200-some people, lose 2 of them before they get past the Azores, continue on around the world with the remaining 3, lose 2 of those, including the captain of the expedition, and finally stagger back to Spain with like 20 people on board after having been gone for 3 years and declare victory. This is not a society which would accept that level of risk. Now, I deplore that, but my deploring of it does nothing to alter the fact. So going to Mars is going to require an assumption of risk that is not commonly done in this nation or in fact any society I know of in the world today. So it requires a change in thinking, but I don't think it requires a lot of a fundamentally different technological nature. Now, there are some things we need to be able to do, just in plain common sense. We need to demonstrate that we can make hardware work off the Earth without substantial human intervention, you know, in difficult environments, other planetary surfaces, for years at a time. Just to be able to get there and back. The analogy I've used in public many times is you got to be able to stuff a crew on board a submarine and tell them and seal the hatches up and tell them to go on a three-year voyage and don't bother me until you get back. Okay, and until we can do that technically, we're not going to go to Mars with a very high probability of success. Now, that's not stuff that's fundamental. I mean, we can learn how to do that, but we have to. So those kinds of things. It's more, to me, it's more the mundane blocking and tackling that we got to do, you know, to get to Mars, which is mostly involved with the decision to do it.
Thank you. Pat Griffin, you mentioned in your speech that the next year perhaps you're starting to recommend architectures for the Mars exploration.
We're going to start looking at them, yes. I don't want to leave my term of office without having done at least a preliminary Mars architecture, recognizing, of course, that it is in the future and it doesn't pay a profit to be overly specific.
It seems that the current architecture of Blue Mars exploration suggests that there is almost a parallel structure with the lunar arc equipment and then perhaps in the future some Martian equipment. Does it make sense to sort of factor in the Mars exploration into the design of the lunar system so that you're not spending, you know, billions of dollars in parallel?
Well, we are trying, yes, of course, we are trying to do that. The first step where we tried to do that was with the heavy lifter and the crew exploration vehicle. If I had wanted an architecture for lunar return, which was the first item on the president's policy requirements list, the best architecture for lunar return obviously would be one vehicle big enough to do the whole job. Okay, we frankly, with the assets we have available, and without going through a clean sheet of paper, couldn't get there. So the next best architecture is that we could figure out was one rendezvous in Earth orbit. Now, if I were just designing a lunar architecture, the most elementary common sense would have told me to make both those vehicles the same size so that I could benefit from economies of production economies in building two of exactly the same vehicle. I didn't do that. Why did we not do that? We didn't do that because if I want to go to Mars, and if I believe I need something like 1 million pounds in orbit to do that, then I want to do that in 5 or 6 launches, not 10 or 12. So the first thing we did on the lunar architecture was to subdivide the Earth orbit rendezvous requirement for getting back to the moon into 2 unequally sized pieces so that the big piece is most suitable for going to Mars. I find it stunning the number of people I talk to who don't get that elementary fact. Okay, and as we look toward Mars architectures, we will be trying to do the same thing. In situ resource utilization is going to be crucial for Mars. We need to start learning how to do that on the moon. Yes, they are not the same environment. Absolutely. But I find it stunning to believe from supposedly rational engineers who'll say, well, you won't learn anything about in-situ resource utilization on Mars by practicing and learning how to do it on the moon. I mean, that cannot be true. Okay, that would be like saying the people who do oil rigs in the deep ocean have nothing of value to contribute to people who drill for oil on the North Slope or in Siberia. There are huge differences. There are also great commonalities. I greatly dislike the didactic positions that many people seem to adopt in these kinds of things. So, yes, of course, we're going to be using the moon as much as possible to help us learn how to go to Mars and beyond. You know, the vision is about becoming a space-faring civilization. Space-faring civilizations go where they can with the technology of their times and they learn to operate in the environments that they have to operate in. And that's what we're going to do.
Hello, Dr. Neal, Rudy Fairfax. A bit of a backward-looking question. Given the $1.5 billion that was spent on preparing the foam insulation and trying to make sure the space shuttle is safer.
Probably closer to three, but go on.
And your case is international cooperation, you wanted to stretch our dollars, but was there any consideration paid, and I know their infrastructure has degraded, toward putting that money where it might go further, to Russia, and providing their equivalent of our space shuttle, their Buran and air base, and using that to supply the space shuttle, or the space station in the infrastructure?
Well, I wasn't around at the time. I wasn't in public service at the time when the space shuttle return to flight decision was being made, so I can't comment. But certainly in my time, there's been no such consideration. Look, I am probably a leading proponent of international cooperation. But international cooperation is not defined as asking other nations for help on how to spend U.S. tax dollars. Okay, U.S. tax dollars go to the U.S. by and large, and international cooperation is done on an exclusive funds basis. We have a broad strategy for where we are going in the United States and in space, and we welcome others to participate in the journey, and that's very sincere. But welcoming others to participate is not the same as helping us spend our money. Ma'am.
Penny Boston from New Mexico Tech. In the work that I do, which is like a research, of course, I'm trying to train fleets of graduate students to enter the workforce. A very enthusiastic graduate student who are very devoted to the idea of going into some aspect of space. But with fundamental science within NASA right now in many areas, specifically the areas that I work in, on standdown, namely astrobiology and non-astrobiology and biology, it's very difficult to imagine how we can continue to produce this workforce. And it's been suggested amongst various people in the community that perhaps NASA itself is not the right agency to be funding the fundamental science. It's been suggested that perhaps science funding be removed from NASA and put within another existing agency like the National Science Foundation. This makes me very uncomfortable, and I'm curious about your views on that sort of reallocation of basic fundamental scientific monies.
Well, NASA does the science that supports the overall NASA mission and the terms of the Space Act and subsequent authorization acts, and that's the science that we do. It is, without fail, traceable to National Academy priorities. Space Studies Board priority is absolutely rooted in priorities that the nation has embraced. We don't make up at NASA, we don't make up those priorities. I don't see anything to be gained by removing the science that NASA does and putting it in some other entity, you would merely have to fund it at that other entity. And the priorities that cause NASA to limit funding to any of its individual portfolios, including science, would still exist at the national level. I mean, the National Science Foundation doesn't have more money than it has because it has been determined as a matter of national policy that, you know, the next $100 million you give out will have more value somewhere else than adding it to the National Science Foundation. And at some very coarse level, that's how it's done. Just moving the money from one agency to another, I don't see that that affects anything of significance. At NASA, and I'll say above NASA, because, you know, frankly, I don't make my own funding decisions. I'm called the administrator because I administer a program whose priorities and policies are given to me by the executive branch and ratified or not by the Congress. Okay, I administer a program. I don't make it up. In this time, given our national funding priorities, it has been determined that about a little less than $17 billion is to be executed to NASA, or is to be handed to NASA to execute, and a little over $5 billion that will go for science. Scientists always want more. I don't blame them. Lost in all the tumult over a reduced level of growth in science, and that's what it is. It is a reduced level of growth. No one has received an actual cut. It's a fine distinction in Washington. Lost in the tumult over all of this is the fact that, you know, the space station guys didn't get all they wanted either. Their flights were cut by a third over the run out of the space station program. Aeronautics certainly doesn't have what it wants. Exploration, the new set of programs, didn't get what it wanted. I had to cut, in my budget recommendation, I had to cut both exploration and science by almost a couple of billion dollars in the case of exploration and a little over a couple of billion dollars in the case of science in order to finish out our legacy commitments on shuttle and station. Some would have us just abolish those legacy commitments. That is not going to happen. A national policy level decision has been made by the chief executive and ratified by the Congress that the United States will not abrogate its legacy commitments, and others who wish to do new things will have to wait in line. That is an unpleasant fact. It's an unpleasant fact to members of the science community, it's an unpleasant fact to members of the aeronautics community, and it is a deeply unpleasant fact to members of the exploration community who look at the money which has gone into shuttle and station and say, gee, look what I could have done with that money if it had been given to me instead of them. I can acknowledge the intellectual argument, but in fact, the national policy decision has been made that this nation will complete its commitments.
That's true, but you also are going to need a workforce as we go on to the next.
Then they will have to be trained to work on what it is we're being asked to do by the Congress and not what it is that they think we ought to be asked to do. Mm-hmm. And we are not being asked at the present to do astrobiology or a huge amount of biology work of any type. Okay, if people wish to be trained and wish to do research and wish to operate on public funding, then they need to look at the budget of the United States as passed by the Congress and determine what it is that we are being asked to do on public money and do that. If they wish to do something else, then they need to find their own money.
Thanks.
Question.
After this summer working with Dr. Steve Powell, the Center for Space Communication, I've come to understand that it could wait to develop a nuclear thermal rocket until we actually need it. It's going to take us a really long time to actually get it developed. What can students and researchers do to accelerate this process so that we can maybe use it to benefit the lunar base?
Nothing. There's nothing you can do. I mean, nuclear rocketry has no stronger advocate than I. Not one. I find it pitiable and pathetic that the United States abandoned its nuclear thermal rocket program in 1973 when we were on the verge of being able to flight test hardware. It would be an immensely useful tool for the exploration of the solar system and starting with the moon. We don't have it. It is a many, many billion dollar enterprise to recreate the work that was done and abandoned. I don't have that money. If it were taken from existing programs, then our human spaceflight program would sit on the ground for years. I don't regard that to be a better alternative. We will not have a nuclear rocket for a fairly lengthy period of time, unless and until it is decided as a matter of national policy that we wish to recreate that, and then it will be a multi-billion dollar enterprise. I don't see anything that students and researchers can do on the margins to alter those facts. I am cynical. I mean, everyone who knows me knows that, and I'm sorry that that is so. It is not an intentional policy that I have to be cynical, but I simply do not see what influence grad students and researchers can have over a national policy level decision that would involve many, many billions of dollars to recreate a capability that we once lost. And I will close my comment in response to your question by saying that again, nuclear power and propulsion for space use utilization has no stronger advocate in the U.S. government than I. I would love to have, you know, the kind of national support to recreate those programs, but we do not. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Terry McIntosh, and I'm with WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. And I was wondering, many people say that we are headed for global catastrophe due to the convergence of several factors, population growth, global warming, rising of the seas, flooding coastal areas worldwide, and many people are going to die, and homes are going to probably start happening very noticeably by 2050. And while a lot of people laugh at it, a lot of scientists are very serious about it. And if this is actually going to come to pass, it's going to be blatantly obvious in the next 10 to 20 years that people are going to start screaming things like, well, let's not go into space, let's spend that money at home to fix these problems. And so my question is, in light of this, do we have time to take a slow plodding course to Mars?
I can't possibly answer that question. Sorry. Ma'am?
First of all, would like to make a comment. Thank you for mentioning the EDA. That's my EDA. I'm not there. I've got three engineers sitting on console running that EDA right now. And
well, at this point, if you need to be there, you screwed up.
I don't need to be there. I handle this with the water.
They should be able to handle it without you.
That's right. That's right.
Good job.
They're doing fine. Thank you. But actually, I wanted to say, Dr. Griffin is very correct. There is a plethora of details that are handled on the ground at Johnson and all the space centers. It's a very difficult job. And it takes a lot of money to handle it. And there isn't enough to go around. But my question to you is this. How, in God's name, can we get any funding to keep the OU back?
The what?
The OU Act, the science rack. Because it's supposed to be put on hold. And, I mean, how can we keep science going for just 1 year?
I don't know.
Okay. But can you look into it, please?
No. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I can't responsibly reach down across three or four levels of management in the organization and turn knobs. Okay. Yes, sir.
I was thinking, first you mentioned that you mentioned one good speaker, but your speech about the mountain man was not my favorite speech today. You mentioned it. And thank you for it. I'm not thinking about regularly and thought about this. But my question is,
I do think that everybody who wants to talk about exploration should read DeVoto's Across the Wide Missouri about the period of initial exploration of the American West by the Mountain Men. It is sobering in the extreme. But go ahead, sorry.
You mentioned the limitations that you had as an administrator. You had to follow the programs that Congress mandates. And I understand that, but we as voters don't have to respect their judgments. We get to have voice our say to them about what we want their program to
do. Absolutely, you do.
And from that standpoint, I've always been a little more when it comes to show, taking the good things that I hear are not show, but ISS. They've got high in the sky things they say could come out of the sound rate. But as an engineer, some of the things related to my field that I've seen didn't really sound practical to me. And so I had a hard time being very supportive of it. And I liked it. And I follow the science news regularly. And I don't recall seeing anything that was exciting to me come out of the ISS. Has there been any scientific, commercial breakthrough or any significant progress made towards us going beyond the ISS so far in the operation of the ISSS? And if not, do you see what you see changing in that as we near completion?
You probably have to delve deeper in the organization to find people who are in a lot closer touch with it than I am. I know that we have both partners and principal investigators on the U.S. lab who are just waiting their turn to get their experiments into flight and have been waiting for years. I won't get into a debate over whether the science that is being done is worth the tens of millions of dollars that we spend.
And I won't do that mostly because we never should have spent tens of billions of dollars to get an ISS. It should have been a much more economically done enterprise, but the past is the past. That said, results to date out of the ISS are necessarily quite limited. We're half done building it. We have just about exactly half the total mass on orbit. And because of the loss at Columbia, we've been operating on a skeleton crew for the last 3.5 years. And of course, in the building phase, you're always going to be on a skeleton crew. It's designed to be useful with a crew of 6 people, 2 of whom are needed just to take care of it. Which, if you think about having 2 people to take care of a 1,000,000-pound facility, 800,000-some-odd-pound facility, having 2 people to take care of it is not unreasonable. And the other 4 are there to do the work. Well, right now, we've got the 2 people there taking care of it. And we just added the 3rd crewman. Until we can add a crew of 6 and of 9, we shouldn't rationally expect a lot of progress. You're almost trying to utilize the thing as you build it. So in all fairness to the space station debate on either side, you know, we're in the middle of building it here. Let's be reasonable. Now, in the longer run, what I expect to get out of the space station for exploration is, frankly, not what many individual scientists or PIs expect to get out of it. I expect to get out of it the knowledge of how to live and work in space. It's a toehold in space for humanity, and we've had some brief toeholds before with Skylab and Salyut and Mir, and people have learned things. But the ISS is no kidding, an order of magnitude bigger, it's an order of magnitude more challenging. The lessons that we learn in finishing that, putting it together and using it are what is going to be the real value between all of you. Thank you.
Sir? Yeah, hi, I'm Fred Page from Arlington, Virginia. Entry, descent, and landing on Mars is a real challenge, obviously. And for manned flights, you'll have a mass much larger than NSL, which is in turn much larger than AR. So I'm just wondering, what is your hunch about how we're going to do it? What do you think is the biggest chunk we'll be able to put on the surface? And do you think that will be one of the drivers for the overall architecture of the missions? That is, there'll be 4 pieces or 2 pieces, or what do you think?
I honestly haven't, in a phrase I sometimes use, I don't really at this point have a right to an opinion because I haven't studied it carefully enough. It is true that we don't have a what I would call a viable entry, descent, and landing scheme applicable to large masses. I mean, we can, of course, do it brute force with propulsion, but I'm not sure that anybody thinks that's the most intelligent approach. So I'm just not at this point prepared to answer your question about chunk size and entry architecture. That is one of the challenges we want to deal with in the next few years.
Yeah, since that would have an implication for how big the boosters you might want to use, is there some way we can accelerate the work of trying to figure out, you know, approaches? Earth or something?
Well, again, if we start looking at Mars architectures, then the next year and the year after that, then the key drivers where we need additional knowledge will pop to the top, and that's where we will spend our money. That's why you do architecture development, is to tell you where you need to spend your money.
Sir?
Greg Gabbert, Alexandria, Virginia. In 2008, I believe we're supposed to have a robot on the moon. Will it look anything like Spirit and Opportunity?
No, in 2008, we're going to have an orbiter around the moon, which is going to get a detailed map, a photogrammetric map, a topographical map, and a resource composition map. Those are its primary purposes. It will be an orbiter around the moon. We will have the second effort in the lunar robotics program will be a lander. That's still a very preliminary definition. I don't know if it will roll or not roll. So, sorry.
I'm John Bernie, kind of aerospace educator from Utah, currently teaching astronomy. And I should know this answer, but I should ask you the question. What's the status of the Hubble telescope right now?
The same as I have said all along, although we're getting closer to an answer, I said, coming to office, that I wanted, if any way
existed to be able to do one last couple service mission to do so, and we will, and if any way exists. We are evaluating the data that we got off the last flight, in particular the use of the boom as a working platform for the crew. We're also, of course, evaluating the crucial data on damage to the orbiter from the tank, because it will be crucial to know that we have gotten foam issues from the tank down to what I'll call the dull roar category, meaning that it may be like the orbiter and it may cause us some maintenance problems, but it will be crucial to know that we cannot break the orbiter with the foam release from the tank. We don't know that yet. We got another flight coming up in end of August, early September. We have a new ice frost ramp design in the works, so I'll remind everybody that the bipod ramp foam that caused the loss of Columbia does not exist anymore. The PAL ramp foam that frightened us last year with the flight of STS-114 does not exist anymore. We've analyzed our way and now flight tested our way to demonstrating that we do not need those pieces of foam. The ice frost ramps are not in the same category, hazard category as those first two, but they are the next one down on the list, and we don't like them, in part because we don't understand even why they perform as well as they do. If we followed our analytical models, they ought to be worse. But we don't like them. We have to fly with them for a little while, but we designed a new ice cross ramp, and I would not fly the Hubble without the new ice cross ramp. We get that done, and then we may be in a position where we can say that there's no piece of foam on the tank now that can kill us. And if I get in that position, then I'm going to do a Hubble flight. I don't think I'm going to know what I personally need to know to satisfy myself until maybe early fall. And I'm in fairly regular touch with our stakeholders on the Hill on this point. They know that I want to do this if I can, but I also do not want to make a decision that should be a strictly technical decision. I do not want to make such a decision and then have it be wrong and have to reverse it later. When I do that, I want to do it right. So that's where we are.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Those are 5 minutes, yeah.
Bob Terry, Columbia, Maryland. I wanted to ask you, John Marburger earlier in this year made a statement that we don't have technology and hardware and expertise to send people to Mars at this time, and went further to recalibrate our entire science and technology effort based on the notion of competitiveness. Now, my question is it fundamentally going to be at odds with the courage you need to be an exploring nation? And if you had further resources available, what percentage increase in the resources would put things on a really robust footing so that we could talk about serious precursor simulations, serious precursor missions like the Transat and like space chambers on Earth to test in situ resources? What sort of increase would be needed?
I can't comment on budgetary increases or decreases. The only budget comments that I can make are that, the president publishes a budget every year. It's arrived at as a result of a year of negotiation between and among the agencies and the Office of Management Budget and other White House staff offices, and that's the budget I support. Sorry.
Jeff Vincent from North Carolina, aerospace engineer. To the fellow, I have a question about research on ISS. Look up spaceresearch.nasa.gov as a pretty good resource for that. My question to Dr. Griffin is, I'm a little concerned that we're stealing computer paper Paul as far as ISS utilization funds are concerned. Can you give me the status of the material science facility rack and the fluids and combustion facility rack? I think it's scheduled to be flown to the station in the next few years. And talk a little bit about the funding block that the appropriators set aside for doing microgravity research on the station that's not related to exploration.
I don't know anything about any of those topics. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'd like to have the time. I'd like you to be able to say that I had the time to dig into the program at that level, but I don't.
Okay, thank you.
This will be the last question.
Okay.
I'm Gus Sheerbaum from Philadelphia. As you're probably aware, most of us here have congressional visits today on Capitol Hill. And I heard you discussing your role as administrator and also your role as getting a number of groups of people, a number of teams that you administer to get on the same page, heading towards the same goal. With your experience working with people that you're working with, what could you lend in terms of words of wisdom from your personal experience as an asset administrator and or your personal experience talking with others that would encourage people that NASA has a noble goal and a noble cause, and moving Mars and beyond is something that is good, because that's going to be what we're going to be arguing, or not arguing, but discussing with a lot of politicians today. Ask people to think about how they think the world looks if the United States is not preeminent in space. And they have to be happy with that outcome, or else they need to support the program.
I think that's the last question.